Arizona has a doctor shortage, and it's had some problems getting physicians licensed. A new proposal, though, could help both problems.
We have a very mobile workforce. People transfer from state to state to state. And if we do not have sort of streamlined licensing in place, it becomes a roadblock to attract people to Arizona.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, Phoenix has a deal to sell the Sheraton Hotel downtown. People have been going nutty for pecans, and that's helping Arizona farmers. And making robots move more like us.
I found that humans can do the robot better than an actual robot. And I find that a comforting irony.
Plus, trying to upend the record industry, and we look out for our own shadows. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Quick check of Valley traffic. I-10 westbound, a crash blocks the on-ramp at Broadway Road. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of only 56 degrees, 70 is average. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the mid-30s, sunny and 57 tomorrow. It's 50 degrees right now. A new state utility regulator was sworn in today, but he says he won't vote on matters involving rooftop solar due to a possible conflict of interest. Andy Tobin, who was appointed by Governor Doug Ducey, is replacing Susan Bittersmith on the State Corporation Commission after she stepped down following conflict of interest allegations. Tobin says he will not vote in rooftop solar cases because his son-in-law is an employee of Solar City. That company is battling Arizona Public Service over its attempts to impose new charges on customers who install rooftop solar. Tobin says he never mentioned the possible conflict to the governor.
And yet, when we went through our disclosure process with our lawyers last week, they were concerned, and we went back and read the statute, and I have to agree with them.
Tobin says he'll refrain from voting in any case in which staff lawyers say there appears to be a conflict, even if that results in a 2-2 tie on the five-member panel. The Phoenix City Council tomorrow is scheduled to vote on a proposed deal to sell the Sheraton Grand Phoenix Hotel downtown. The $300 million sale to an arm of a Maryland-based firm could be finalized as early as April. Joining me with more on the pending deal is Jeremy Legg, Special Projects Manager for the Phoenix Convention Center. He's been working on this for a while. And Jeremy, why is this a good deal for the city?
Absolutely. There are a variety of benefits to the city of selling the hotel to this buyer. So first of all, it gives the city the opportunity to eliminate more than $300 million in debt. So just wiping that off the books really provides a financial benefit to the city. Additionally, on a going forward basis, as we know, markets go up, markets go down. There's no longer any financial risk to the city based on the performance of this particular hotel or the hotel market in general. But on the upside, going forward, the city will still have access to a 1,000-room convention hotel. That's absolutely critical for the ongoing success of the Phoenix Convention Center. Also, from a revenue standpoint, there's ongoing sales tax revenue that's generated by the hotel. And then finally, the buyer is somebody with industry-leading hospitality, knowledge, and experience, and so the hotel will be in great hands going forward, so this asset continue to perform well for the downtown community, as well as the tourism industry and the Phoenix Convention Center.
Given the amount of time that the city had been looking at potentially selling this hotel, are you surprised at the offer that this buyer came in with?
We were very excited to hear the offer and to have it come in a relatively short time frame. I think that actually speaks volumes to have a caliber of buyer of this magnitude with an offer of this degree. I think really speaks volumes about how far downtown Phoenix has come as a market. Not only speaks well to the asset itself and to the management team in place and to the activities generated at the Phoenix Convention Center, but it, as you know, with real estate, location, 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 and we wouldn't have got a buyer like this with an offer like this if the downtown Phoenix location was not great as it is, with potential for even more growth.
What will the city do with the money once the hotel is sold?
So the city has about $306 million in debt associated with the hotel today, and between the $300 million sales price and then existing cash that's in hotel accounts and net operating profit will continue to accrue over the next couple of months before we close. that will be able to wipe out that $306 million in debt.
Will this ultimately be a break even for the city? Will the city make a little extra cash on this?
So it really depends on how you look at it. In the past, the city has had to contribute about $29 million from its sports facilities fund to help pay debt service on the hotel. And the deal was, back in 2005, was specifically structured that way, where sports facilities fund would be used as a backstop. But if you look at it from the perspective of how much the city has collected in sales tax revenues from the hotel and how much will continue to accrue over the years, all of that money will be coming back to the city and then some.
Do you think that the city, given the experience that it's gone through with this hotel, do you think that the city is going to be doing anything like this again? Not necessarily with the hotel, but some other kind of venture like this? Or do you think this is going to be it for Phoenix?
Well, the city has, bold and visionary leadership, and we've entered into a lot of great initiatives over time that have been good for the city. I don't see the city getting back into the hospitality business or hotel business per se anytime soon, but there are always opportunities out there, and we'll see what the next big thing is.
Jeremy Legg is Special Projects Manager for the Phoenix Convention Center, talking about the pending sale of the Sheraton downtown. Jeremy, thank you.
You're welcome.
A legislative committee this afternoon is debating a bill that would have Arizona join a multi-state compact for licensing doctors. 12 states have already joined the compact, including Nevada, Utah, and Minnesota. At least 5 states besides Arizona have proposed joining so far this year. State Representative Heather Carter is the sponsor of House Bill 2502, which would lay the groundwork for Arizona to join. And Representative Carter, why should the state be a part of this?
Basically, what this is going to allow Arizona physicians to do is to have their license be more portable to other states that also have a compact in place, and it will allow the state of Arizona to attract physicians from those states so that we can have an easy, streamlined licensing process, both within Arizona and between other states.
How much of your interest in this is based on some of the problems that have been going on at the state medical board as far as licensing doctors and the amount of time it takes and following the rules that they have set up for themselves?
Obviously, concern with the time frame that it takes the Arizona Medical Board to license a physician is part of the conversation that we are having here, but it actually goes well beyond that. We are looking at putting Arizona at the front of the line in terms of attracting physicians to Arizona, and this is one way to do that.
And presumably each state would have the same licensing rules and requirements and standards and everything?
So there's two checks and balances that are in place. Number one, any physician transferring or moving to Arizona will still be held to the same Arizona standards that we have now. In addition, this will allow Arizona to have additional information about physicians transferring to our state via the compact. We will be able to share information across state lines about disciplinary action. So right now, that is not necessarily the case without extra steps in the process. This will streamline that process, so it actually provides additional checks and balances. This retains the state control of the licensing process, and that is a critical component to the compact. This is a way for us to address some of our challenges we have in Arizona with having a physician shortage and a healthcare practitioner shortage in general. So I do believe this is the wave of the future to allow states to retain state control, but account for the mobility that exists in the healthcare workforce.
How big of a bite do you think that joining this compact could put in the state's physician shortage?
I think this is one tool in the toolbox that we can use to address our physician shortage. There are other things we need to do as well, for example, focusing on graduate medical education. But now, if we can also recruit physicians from around the country to say, you have an opportunity to have a streamlined licensing process to come to Arizona, that will be one additional caveat we can provide for physicians. So I do believe this will provide us one tool in the toolbox, but I think there are other things we need to do as well.
Given the number of states that are already a part of this and the number that could join at some point, does that potentially hurt Arizona, the more states that are in as far as trying to recruit? Because if you're a doctor, you can pretty much go anywhere, the more states that are in this. Does that diminish Arizona's role in being able to recruit somewhat, do you think?
Well, I think all things being equal, Arizona is a fabulous place to work, live, and raise a family and start a physician's practice. So I think we're competitive just by the very nature of being the state of Arizona. But in addition, if you look at the workforce now, we have a very mobile workforce. People transfer from state to state to state. And if we do not have sort of streamlined licensing in place, it becomes a roadblock to attract people to Arizona. But if we do have a compact in place, now that decision to transfer from, let's say, Utah to Arizona or from Illinois to Arizona is a much easier decision because you know you're not looking at a roadblock at the licensing process as one of the reasons why you're not coming to Arizona.
State Representative Heather Carter of Cave Creek is the chair of the House Health Committee and sponsor of House Bill 2502, which would have Arizona join a multi-state medical licensing compact. The Phoenix Suns are in the midst of one of their worst seasons in franchise history. Following their 19th loss in 21 games on Sunday, the team fired head coach Jeff Hornacek. Today, they introduced their new interim head coach, Earl Watson, who was promoted after serving as one of Hornacek's assistants. KJZZ's Phil Latzman was at this morning's news conference and joins us with more. Phil, what was said?
So, Mark, as you mentioned, the Suns, once the toast of the sports town here in the Valley, are now among the NBA's worst teams. They have a 14-35 record. They're on their way to missing the playoffs for a franchise-worst sixth straight season. And today, the team's in battle general manager Ryan McDonough told the assembled media at Talking Stick Resort Arena that the Suns' dismal performance was not all on Hornacek.
A lot of that is not Coach Hornacek's fault. I take a lot of responsibility, most of the responsibility for what's gone on and what's gone wrong with this organization over the past few months.
Then he introduced the 36-year-old Watson as the Suns' new coach. He'll make his debut on the sidelines tonight when they host the Toronto Raptors. Watson is a former guard. He served mostly as a backup after starring in college at UCLA, where he says legendary coach John Wooden was one of his role models. And he paid homage to the fired Hornacek, who hired him as part of his staff this season, and says he gave him his blessing.
And I called Coach, and I asked him, what did you want me to do? And he told me it's hard to pass up a first opportunity if you get it. He said, I could never tell you not to take it, and basically gave me his blessing. We had some other private conversations moving forward, but I love him, I respect him, and it's unfortunate, and it's a tough position to be in. You never want to get it this way. You want to help build it and go off in a positive direction.
So, Phil, what did Watson say about whether he might one day get this job permanently?
Well, Mark, he says he's not even thinking about that right now.
I'm coaching as an opportunity. You know, whatever happens tomorrow, I can't control. I can only control right now in this moment that will impact tomorrow. So I'm not worried about the summer or the process or what happens next. Who knows? I couldn't tell you this was going to happen last week, so you never know what could happen.
And with the NBA trade deadline coming up on the 18th, Phil, did you get a sense that the Suns will be big players there?
Oh, yeah. I asked Ryan McDonough about just that, whether we can expect the Suns to be active, and here's what he said.
Yeah, I think so. Well, you never know, right? You never know what other teams would be looking to do. But obviously we're not happy with the way our season's gone, with the way the team's played recently. And so we'll be making a lot of calls, receiving a lot of calls, I'm sure. So we'll look to be active, but you know, whether a deal or deals happen, I don't know. It's impossible to say in advance.
And Mark, you know, a lot of what was discussed was trying to repair the fractured relationship with Suns fans who have endured some pretty lousy basketball lately. And they may not make the playoffs, but they do have a chance to make a good impression in front of the home fans. 9 of their next 10 are here in Phoenix, including tonight's game against the Raptors.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Thanks, Phil.
Thank you, Mark.
Still to come, the pecan crop in Arizona is experiencing a growth spurt.
The last survey I saw, they estimated there's about 7,500 to 8,000 acres of new pecans either in or being planted in Arizona in the next several years.
What's behind the trend? Is it sustainable? All will be revealed. It's the show. Good afternoon. Happy Tuesday. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic, I-10 westbound, a crash in the intersection at Broadway. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 56 degrees. It's sunny and 50 at KJZZ at 218.
KJZZ is supported by El Encanto, providing the sights, sounds, and taste of Mexico for 25 years with restaurants in Cave Creek, Desert Hills, and Fountain Hills, lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch, weddings, and large events. ElEncantoRestaurants.com.
And now, all of you Tuesday morning pundits, it's time to pay close attention to all those men and women on the campaign trail behind the curtain. The Takeaway's Todd Zwillick takes us there.
You kind of don't want to show people what really goes on behind the scenes.
We should start by prepping the governor with Russian economic policy.
You can't count how many times I've been across this state.
You're the strategy guy.
But you're the body man.
I definitely carried a bag that's full of all the things that they could need.
I got coffee, I got ginseng, I got protein bars.
That's following them around with a camera, it's following them around with a microphone.
We need to hire an operative to do research, you see what I mean?
Just one poll, those things aren't scientific.
Maybe politics isn't for you.
We have a campaign that we've got to win, you understand?
It's a series all this week we're calling Road Warriors, Life on the Campaign Trail. And long before a candidate ever jumps onto a stage to screaming crowds, long before an aspiring senator appears in front of hay bales or admiring a butter sculpture at the Iowa State Fair, the advance team is there to make sure everything goes exactly right. And that means that people like Charlie Pierce are in control days, sometimes weeks, ahead of the candidate. Charlie is a Republican advance man, and his job can mean anything from booking hotels to making sure the boss looks picture perfect in front of voters. He's worked on advance teams for Mitt Romney, for John McCain, and for Sarah Palin. And he says that advance has to think of everything that needs to go right, and especially everything that can go wrong.
So, you know, you start with trying to get your date, your location, what type of event it's going to be. And then once you get all that settled, you start moving into the really mundane logistics of the event. You know, how many press are we expecting in attendance? And now you have to wire an internet and enough power, and you got to decide how big of a crowd you want. And then you go into your event setup. What do you want your tight shot to be? That's the picture right behind the candidate. That's 90% of what television cameras use. And then you get down to what's called the TikTok. So you walk through every second, every minute of Governor Romney's participation in the events.
Let's talk about when things go wrong, because they can. There is a Romney event that's kind of famous in political circles around Washington, and I'm sure Boston these days, about when he appeared in a football stadium in Detroit. Can you explain what happened from your perspective at that event?
The RSVPs for the original venue they had for the Detroit Economic Club had just massively over exceeded what they were expecting. So the Detroit Economic Club heads wanted to switch it to doing the event on Ford's Field. Now, the optics of that, as our advance teams knew, were that while 1,500 people could fit in the field, that there's 50,000 or so fixed seats surrounding the stadium that we were not going to fill.
And so to be clear, Charlie Pierce, what happened was you had a shot from the field that made the candidate look like he was at a rally with 1,500 people, which is pretty good. But if you went up in the rafters, which reporters did, and took a picture, it looked like Mitt Romney in Michigan, his dad's home state, was speaking in front of an empty stadium.
Correct. And sometimes perception is reality. And just as a counter to that, neither could Barack Obama at this time in his in his presidency. Maybe in the hype of 08, he was filling stadiums. But during the DNC convention, they had to take it out of a big stadium, I believe, in Charlotte, which they claimed for weather, but was clearly because they couldn't get the people.
So I also want to talk about a time when things really seemed to go right for you. Now, when you were working for John McCain on his presidential campaign, you got tasked to do advance for his new vice presidential pick, somebody who was unknown, right?
Correct. Yeah, I was the vice presidential advance team was originally going to be more of a skeleton crew just to get whoever the vice presidential candidate was going to be to their fundraising events and just more second tier level presidential style campaign events. Obviously, with Governor Palin, her crowds required some top level advance guys. And I was fortunate enough to be at some unique moments in history as a site advance guy for her vice presidential announcement event, which was really exciting in Dayton, Ohio.
Governor Sarah Palin of the great state of Alaska.
and her UN trip to New York City during the UN General Assembly week.
Now let's listen to a clip from a famous interview that Governor Palin did with Katie Couric. This wound up being a famous exchange that you had something to do with. Listen.
It's very important when you consider even national security issues with Russia, as Putin rears his head and comes into the airspace of the United States of America. Where do they go? It's Alaska. It's just right over the border.
Now, Charlie Pierce, that interview wound up to be very famous. It led to bits like this from Tina Fey.
Every morning when Alaskans wake up, one of the first things they do is look outside to see if there are any Russians hanging around. If there are, you gotta go up to them and ask, what are you doing here? And if they can give you a good reason, they can, then it's our responsibility to say, you know, shoo, get back over there.
Now, from the campaign's perspective, that turned into sort of a comedy meme, except the sets were all sort of recreated in popular culture afterward.
Yeah, it was sort of bizarre, that room for the Katie Couric interview. It was actually surrounded by glass, so we had to bring in all this pipe and drape, and the team did a great job of really dressing it up. And then to a few days later to watch pretty much Down to the Flowers recreated on SNL was pretty interesting. And
now, you also had a candidate in Governor Palin who didn't have any foreign policy experience at the time. You all went to New York around a UN conference and made her look like somebody on the world scene.
Yeah, it's actually pretty simple. I mean, basically the format you want to use is that it's a tete-a-tete or a bilateral meeting. So it's Governor Palin looking like a head of state meeting with another head of state. The difficult part was we were basically using hotel rooms across New York City and conference areas to bring in flags to and then get these setups lit and staged right so that it looked like we were just holding a series of meetings in the UN, even though we were in 5 to 10 different places scattered across New York City, mostly hotels. So from an opticals perspective, that event was a big success for our advance team.
But Charlie Pierce, let's talk about the downside of that. Do you ever have a concern that this takes something away from voters, that the showbiz of politics is an artifice that in a way is dishonest for any voter looking at a campaign?
You know, I don't think so. And I used to actually think about that. And part of it, the reason I had some trepidations about doing this interview, you kind of don't want to show people what really goes on behind the scenes, right? The sort of the pulling the curtain back on the Wizard of Oz that, oh, what's going on? But at the same time, I think voters actually appreciate that more. And you, especially in this cycle, you can tell people come out to these rallies. They want to be energized. They want to be, you know, excited by something. And it's just sort of a necessary artifice of modern campaigns.
Hey, Charlie Pierce, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Todd. Glad to be on.
Charlie Pierce is a consultant with Pathfinder.gop, currently consulting with the Chris Christie campaign.
That's The Takeaways, Todd Zwillick. The state's pecan crop is going through a growth spurt. Thanks to increasing demand, farmers have been able to fetch some historically high prices in recent years. And as KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, many farmers are now banking that the trend will continue and planting thousands of new acres, especially here in Arizona.
It's harvest season at the Green Valley Pecan Orchard in Sahuarita, Arizona, which means right now it can feel a lot like it's raining pecans. Farm manager Alan Brandt explains it starts with an army of large machines that grab hold of the pecan trees and then shakes the nuts off their branches.
Pecans are a three-step process.
Once on the ground, they're gathered, sorted, and depending on the farm, they can be shelled too.
My father began planting pecans in 1965.
Dick Walden is the president of Farmers Investment Company, the parent company of this pecan farm. He says right now, business is good.
There's a strong international demand, has been growing since the early 80s.
That market growth began when demand for pecans took hold in Europe. But Walden says in the last 10 years, the growth has been more drastic.
China has become a major importer of in-shell pecans, using recent numbers, maybe 18 or 20% of the world's pecan supply have been destined for China.
He says recent scientific publications on the nutritional value of nuts have helped too, because now the world's consumers consider them a health food full of good fats and not just a junk food. And it was factors like these that convinced the Walden family to make the decision to expand their orchard.
Production capacity will close to double.
But this decision isn't an easy one for any farmer, because unlike other produce such as corn or potatoes, orchards are more of an investment. Harold Payne is the president of the Arizona Pecan Growers Association.
People who plant pecan trees are forward-thinking. They're looking to the future. It isn't a crop that you, if the market goes bad, decide where you're going to take it out, because you're married to that crop once you put it in the ground.
He explains it takes about 10 years for pecan trees to mature and reach full productivity. In fact, most farmers don't start making money on their new acres until about that time. But even with that cost, Payne says many are deciding to take the plunge now.
We don't have hard numbers because nobody really does an accurate survey, but the last survey I saw, they estimated there's about 7,500 to 8,000 acres of new pecans either in or being planned in Arizona in the next several years.
That's a 50% increase in this state alone, a number mirrored by nationwide trends. Arizona State University agribusiness economist Tim Richards explains when it comes to pecans, these farmers have to look at the market in the long term. That's partly why the supply and demand curve can get so unbalanced and prices now are as high as they are. When demand increases for pecans, increasing their supply takes a long time.
The interesting thing about pecans is that, you know, in general, it's not your, you know, mom and pop with an acre kind of thing. These are big companies with a lot of investment and a lot of capital.
He says with fewer players, the market is slightly less volatile than other foods. But as sluggish growth conditions in China continue to result in significant losses for other Arizona industries like copper mining, is banking on sustained Chinese demand for pecans a smart move? Richards says, yes, at least for the foreseeable future.
If that doomsday scenario doesn't happen, there still is a simple fact that there's 1.3 billion people. They're becoming more wealthy. They're starting to have Western diets. And they're having our health problems, too, unfortunately. So as they have their health problems, they start to turn to healthier foods, kind of ironically, down the road. And pecans and walnuts and almonds are a big part of that story.
Which means, for the time being, pecan orchards here and throughout the country will continue to expand. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, reporting from Sahuarita, Arizona.
It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein.
The record industry was once dominated by huge companies that were themselves owned by even bigger conglomerates. But changes in how people make music, and more importantly, purchase music, caused a dramatic shift in the industry. That and technological advances has some smaller labels seeking new opportunities. A couple of Valley residents in their early 20s have decided to jump in and have started to rethink records to work with local musicians. They're Jordan Tomeno and Zach James, and they join me now. Jordan, why is your business going to work in this current landscape?
We have to look at like the profit models of the record industry and how they stand as of now. And when you look at it, they operate off 360 deals. And basically what a record label is, it's a record investment company. They give you money, they give you services, and then they recoup their money based on sales on the back end and then take a high percentage because it is a high interest risk. So musicians end up taking a smaller percentage due to the high, you know, the high risk. And so what we have is a model that is still based around mechanical record sales, mm-hmm. even though it's not even a thing anymore. So it's kind of one of those things when you look at it logically, you're like, that doesn't make any sense. The basis and where we fit in is that we give, you know, independent artists access to the tools that otherwise they wouldn't have access to mm-hmm. at a price that is significantly lower than if they were to try to achieve these different things on their own.
Some people are going to say, a couple of young guys in Phoenix, how are they going to spin it? So what's the plan here?
So the plan is what we've done and what we like really value that we do better than most people is creative partnerships with other companies. So a lot of other companies that we work with, we use upfront retainers to keep these people working with us instead of against us. So we have a lot of partnerships, especially with like Tall Cat Studios, where we can do professional recording at a fraction of what anyone else in the city is doing it for. And then we offer these like wholesale prices to our artists, and we're doing the same with video, we're doing the same with PR, we're doing the same with graphic design and promotion and booking. It's all being done in-house or through creative partnerships. So then we can provide these services at a cost that no one else can get. We label ourselves as a record label, but we're a service-based one-stop shop for these musicians. Okay. And we're here to like cultivate a space and a home for them to really like flourish and really like get access to everything they need to make their career the best it can be.
And you're going to focus on local artists?
So as of now, since our services are set up in the Valley, our goal is to work with Phoenix musicians only. As time goes on, we plan to expand to other cities, but for now, we want to start right here where it all started for us.
Yeah, do you have a special passion for Phoenix music?
Absolutely.
Yes. Grew up in it, live it, breathe it.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's where I got my start.
Well, let's talk a little more about the subscription model. What are the bands going to pay you guys a certain, all right, so they're going to pay a certain fee to get these services from you. Mm-hmm. Is it a partnership or are they really hiring you to work for them?
They're hiring us.
Okay.
So it's the whole, I mean, basically what we did is we took the profit model of the record industry and we just put it in reverse. The way it works currently is that when you get onto a record label, you work for them. They hire you and a lot of time they buy rights to your intellectual property and own your intellectual property. And then you cut the record for them so that they can make profits and they pay you out based on it because you are an employee of them in the most technical way. Us, we work for you. We do not own your music. We do not plan to own your music. You are the creative director. We are just simply here to curate and help you get to the next level. And so we flipped it around. So that's why people pay on the front end so that they can retain their profits on the back end.
Yeah. I want to believe you entirely, but I also feel like when people hit bumps, you know, it's sometimes change up. So how are you ready if those bumps do come along? I mean, they inevitably will, even if you guys are ultra successful.
We're about as prepared as we can be. You know, make sure that the lawyers on retainer, the PR firm's right, that we have, you know, all of our ducks covered, that, you know, when we understand publishing law, what's going to happen, that, you know, we have a good understanding of where we lie, that our contracts that we do have, you know, with production are in place. And a lot of this stuff is like, I'm not going to sit here and lie to you. If something comes up, I guess we'll just have to take it as it comes. Because I could sit here and say that I have all these grand ideas. But in reality, the things I think are going to be problems probably won't be. And the things that are problems are things I've never thought of. You know, I think that as long as we keep a good heart and we keep our morals and our ethics in line, that we'll be protected. Most important, we don't get skewed by, you know, so many different aspects, that we will be okay.
Jordan Tomeno and Zach James. They're in charge of the new Valley-based business called Rethink Records.
So by now you probably know that Punxsutawney Phil, the prognosticating groundhog from Pennsylvania, predicted an early spring. Well, KJZZ's own Phoenixsutawney Phil, Latsman that is, prognosticating reporter, makes his own prediction.
And rather than consulting my shadow, I decided to consult Ben McMahon with climate assessment for the Southwest.
The next couple weeks actually look pretty dry, maybe a little warmer than average. Now, the lingering question is how much El Nino will still continue to play a role, because the next 2 weeks look a little dry, but there's still a very good chance that El Nino will bring us some wetter weather as the spring proceeds.
So, my prediction, 2 weeks of spring, followed by 4 more weeks of winter. We'll see who's right come mid-March.
Coming up on the show, a first-of-its-kind summit planned to empower Native American kids in our state.
The only way we're going to be able to move these communities forward is to begin to look at opportunities where we, yes, hold on to our culture and tradition and language, but also embrace the ability to seek progress.
That's just ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, I-10 westbound, a crash in the intersection at Broadway. Look for sunny skies this afternoon with a high of 56. 55 was yesterday's high. 70 is average for today. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the mid-30s. Sunny and 57 tomorrow. It's 51 degrees under sunny skies at KJZZ at 236.
KJZZ is supported by TGen, a nonprofit medical research institute founded in Arizona, bringing precision medicine from the laboratory bench to the patient's bedside. You can support TGen's science at tgen.org.
In a look at international news, Brazil's famous Carnival celebrations begin in earnest on Saturday, despite growing concerns over the spread of the mosquito-borne Zika virus. The Carnival is one of the main events in the country's tourism calendar. There's fear that more travel in and out of the country could help spread the virus. But over the weekend, thousands of revelers attended street parades across Rio, and the BBC's Julia Carneiro went to find out if concerns over Zika would dampen the mood.
The band is playing in scorching heat and a crowd is dancing along next to the iconic colonial aqueduct here in Rio's Lapa district. Everyone's dressed up in costumes. There are clowns, pirates, mermaids, and lots of confetti up in the air. Despite the international fear over the spread of the Zika virus, Carnival here doesn't look any different. But let's see if people here are taking any precautions.
She
says she's thinking about that every day and using mosquito repellent every day, and it's something that people really do have to worry about, and she is worried. Here's a young lady dressed up as a ballerina. Are you worried about Zika and Carnival?
Actually, I should be worried about Zika, but now I'm just having fun, you know? I just want to have fun.
Did you use any repellent before you left home?
No, I should, but no. I think this period is the moment just to forget everything and just enjoying everything, so that's why.
And I just met a friend that's paying homage to David Bowie this year. She has the blue and red Bowie ray painted across her face. Is this fear of Zika changing the way you behave in Carnival in any way?
Yes, I'm kind of afraid because I had Zika in December and now I have another rash and I don't know what's going on because I don't know if I'm really immune or if I can have it twice, I don't know.
Are you taking any precautions during Carnival because of the Zika virus? For instance, are you using repellent before you leave home?
Not actually, but I should, but no.
Now, Carnival is traditionally a time when people poke fun at whatever's going on politically or in world news. And I just met a man that's dressed up as a Zika control agent. He's spraying water on everyone, pretending it's insecticide.
We are all worried. This is a very grave matter in Brazil. I hope it doesn't scare visitors away. But it's Carnival, so I decided to play around a bit. The word Zika has two meanings in Portuguese. It's the disease, but it's also the word for a jinx or a bad omen. So I'm spraying water on people to take the bad energies away.
That's the BBC's Julia Carneiro in Brazil. A group of Valley-based organizations wanted to know more about the relationship between sex trafficking and homeless young adults, so they asked them about it. Tumbleweed Center for Youth Development teamed up with Our Family and 1 in 10 on the surveys. Melissa Brocky is the Director of Health and Wellness at Tumbleweed.
We really wanted to look at, what are the experiences that our youth are having? Are they having sex trafficking experiences? There's some conversation that homeless youth often have survival sex, and so it looks different. And so we really wanted to do research that evaluated this to see if we really needed to modify or change some of our programs. And what we found in 2014 was that almost 25% of them reported having a sex trafficking experience. And a year later in 2015, 35% reported having a sex trafficking experience. We don't necessarily think it jumped 10% over the course of a year, but in the last year, once we got the 2014 survey back, we really looked at how do we address this in our population and in our programs. And so our Family Services and Tumbleweed included an assessment where we talk about trafficking, where we engage our youth in some groups we run. So we try to reduce some of the shame and stigma that comes with it. So we really brought that research out to identify how to engage our youth and make sure that we're creating best practices around the services we're offering them.
Do you get the sense that the numbers that you found in Arizona are comparable to what happens in other places?
I get asked that a lot. You know, I mean, there's not a ton of data going out. There are a number of research entities that I think are really starting to look into this problem. We sort of based our survey off of what Covenant House did in New York, which had similar results. So it's hard to say from city to city. Obviously, larger cities are going to look a little bit different than smaller rural towns, right? There's not a lot of research that's been really done on what rural communities look like.
In your mind, is education the best way to try to address this? Are there other things that could be done to try to bring the numbers down?
You know, I think there's a number of things. So we recently at Tumbleweed received a Department of Justice grant that gave us the capacity to build our clinical team. And so now we have a trafficking-specific counselor that works one-on-one with our youth as well as doing group education. And so one of the things we're getting trained on in March is a program called My Life, My Choice, which was developed by a survivor-led organization. And it's more prevention. It's more focused on self-esteem and helping young girls understand what a healthy relationship looks like. So some of it's a prevention piece, you know, not necessarily going in and saying this is what sex trafficking looks like, but looking at all of the other elements that we know are indicators of someone being at risk or vulnerable for sex trafficking and educating them on that.
Based on the research that you've done, is there a connection between people who have been victims of sex trafficking and their homelessness? I mean, does it cause them to become homeless? Does it preclude them from finding a home and sort of ending that cycle?
Well, I think we know that homeless youth are extremely vulnerable. I think it's hard to say if you've been trafficked if you have a more likely rate of being homeless. We haven't really asked that specific question, but we know these negative life experiences, having been sexually abused, having ran away from home, experiencing dating violence and things like that are all indicators for us that could lead someone to eventually become sex trafficked.
Looking into your crystal ball for a second, when you ask these questions again next year, what do you expect to see as the results relative to what you've seen over these past 2 years?
Well, I would hope to say that we don't have another jump in our numbers. I think we did year two to really look at, was this an anomaly? I hope next year they don't increase. I hope with some of the therapeutic services that we're putting in place in our programs that we're, and the prevention elements that we're seeing a decrease in some of these numbers. But it's hard to say. You know, a lot of our kids aren't necessarily actively being trafficked during the time of our engagement. It happened to them when they were minors. And so we really have to have a little bit more of a concentrated look on the systems involved.
Melissa Bronchi is the Director of Health and Wellness at Tumbleweed Center for Youth Development. From poverty to high dropout rates, Native American kids and teens on and off reservations in Arizona often face challenges. That's why Arizona State Senator Carlisle Begay, who grew up on the Navajo Nation, recently announced he'll be organizing the first ever statewide Native American Youth Leadership Summit this April to address some of those issues and empower a new generation of Native Americans. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger caught up with the senator in between votes at the state capitol to talk about the summit. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Mark.
So who is Begay aiming to bring to the summit?
He's targeting middle schoolers and high schoolers, and he's partnering with schools around the state, as well as the Governor's Office of Youth, Faith, and Family, and the Morningstar Youth Leadership Council, a nonprofit devoted to Native American youth in the Phoenix area. And Senator Begay said he wants this to be a totally youth-led summit. So the Youth Council actually got to decide what issues they want to discuss at the summit themselves.
And what ideas did they come up with?
They're planning to focus on a few areas: health, including mental health and substance abuse issues, domestic violence, the state of education on reservations, and social issues like bullying. And Begay told me they're interested in talking about some of the governmental policies that have shaped life for Native Americans today.
They wanted to highlight American Indian policy. I think for them it was fundamentally about the importance of how far our tribal communities have come, but also in the context of the different eras of policies that have benefited or even have harmed our tribal communities, and making sure that we understand and have context of our history.
So, Lauren, what does Senator Begay hope to get out of the summit?
He said there's a huge need to prepare the next generation of Native Americans for the job market, and he really talked a lot about the hopelessness he hears about from many of them. Here's what he had to say about that.
We have the largest high school dropout rate of any racial or ethnic group. We have the lowest high school graduation rate. Even of the Native American kids that graduate from high school, the Arizona Board of Regents recently released a report this past summer that highlighted that only 33.7% of Native American high school graduates are even eligible for admission into any post-secondary institution. And for me, that's a big concern, because if we are looking at the future of our Native American communities, and if these statistics and demographics represent what is the reality today, it should be alarming. And I think that part of the effort of the Youth Leadership Summit is to bring together youth and get them to begin to see that they are the future, that they are the future leaders of our communities, and most importantly, to be engaged as young as they are in their own community.
And how old will these kids who are going to participate be?
So we're targeting junior high and high school students, especially because in junior high and high school, students begin to look at and hopefully see themselves wanting to know what they're going to do after high school. One of the great passions that I have in my life, and in particular this position and role here in the state Senate, is speaking to the youth. I was in the White Mountain Apache tribe last spring, and I had an opportunity to speak to an entire high school class. And the other thing I like to do is pick on students who seem to be least engaged. And there was a student in the very back of this auditorium who had a baseball cap on, hood on, had earphones in his ears, and so really walked all the way back and started engaging and asking him questions. And similar to the question of what are your goals, his response was, why do you care and why do I matter? And that was really, I think, for me, an eye-opening kind of just experience, because my biggest concern was how many more of his peers have the same outlook in their life, especially because these are kids who are growing up in conditions where perhaps 80% of their community members are unemployed, maybe the highest suicide rate in number of Native American communities in the state, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, domestic violence. And so despite this environment, I am, I guess, trying to target youth to get them to see that that isn't hopefully the expectation that they see themselves in their life and in the future of what they look at in the future of their own communities.
What did you say to him in that moment?
Well, I think for me, and that's a very similar response to I've heard in different variations from other kids, is to try to get them to understand they do matter. I grew up in a tribal community. I grew up in an environment with no running water, no electricity. I was raised in a home. My grandmother, who just passed away a week and a half ago, grew up in a generation where she had never stepped a day in her life in a classroom, never learned how to read or write, never learned how to speak English. But yet her identity and her wisdom was based and rooted in the fact that she wanted all of her grandkids to get an education. She saw that as an important part of the future of not only our own family, but the future of our own community. As of today, every one of our tribal communities are not isolated as they were once before. You know, there's a great big world out there, and the only way we're going to be able to move these communities forward is to begin to look at opportunities where we, yes, hold on to our culture and tradition and language, but also embrace the ability to seek progress in a very global world.
That was State Senator Carlisle Begay talking about the first ever statewide Native American Youth Leadership Summit he's holding this April.
KJZZ's Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
53 degrees at KJZZ at 253.
KJZZ is supported by Essence Bakery, located in Tempe and now 3830 East Indian School, featuring breakfast, organic lunches, and specialty pastries, including French macaroons and croissants. More information at EssenceBakery.com.
How human should robots be? How about how human should they act? How much like human should they move? Those are some of the questions Lance Garavi thinks about. He's an associate professor in the School of Film, Dance, and Theater at ASU, and one of the areas in which he's currently working, as he describes it, is at the intersection of robotics and performance. So, Lance, where is that intersection right now in your mind?
We're trying to teach a robot how to move and behave like a human being. As I told the director of the Astral Robotics Lab in the School of Earth and Space Exploration, I said, you and I aren't really all that different. We're both concerned with performance, the performance of materials, the performance of systems. The one extra thing that I think I and some of my performance theater colleagues are concerned with is the performance of organic autonomous systems. That is to say, people.
Why do this? I mean, what's the utility of having a robot that can move like we do?
Well, why do this and what's the utility are two different questions, I would say. Why do this? One, because robots are cool. Robots are interesting and fun. What is the utility? We're facing a future in which robots will be more and more ubiquitous. And if that is to be the case, what is it we want those experiences to be like? We have to start, to use a theatrical term, staging that.
Why is theater the right venue to be doing that?
As I said, I am concerned, much like engineers and scientists, with performance. I think it has to do with if these robots are going to live with us and interact with us, they're going to be players in the dramas that are our lives, and they're going to have to know how to respond when we act around them.
So is the goal to make it so that the robots can sort of figure out on their own based on how somebody is approaching them or an action that another person gives to them, as opposed to having, like, somebody walks up to give a high five and you or somebody has to push a button to make the robot raise its arm to give a high five?
Oh.
Like, is the goal to have the robot be able to figure out how to respond appropriately to a given action?
Yeah, I mean, what you're describing, that where you have someone pushing a button to get the robot to do a high five, that's a place that we've already been in our work. The robot I'm working with over at ASU is named Baxter, and it's an anthropomorphic robot. It's a human-shaped robot built for light industrial work, and a lot of research institutions are using Baxter as a platform. But the first project I did with the robotics lab was put together a device, a performance called U-N.0 that was two clowns, an aerialist, and a robot, which sounds like the beginning of a joke.
I was just thinking that exact thing, yes.
So we were operating in that instance on what I call the remote control model of robotics. That is to say, we created this very friendly interface where we could control the robot from an iPad, and we had pre-programmed all of the moves and operations that we wanted the robot to do. The problem with so many robots is they either move very stiffly and awkwardly, or robots might move weirdly, like a Roomba moves just in a weird, weird way. We don't think of robots moving in a way that we associate with human movement. So if we wanted to teach a robot how to move in a human way, well, how do we learn to move as humans? We wanted to get human movement into the body of a robot. Now we're on to a new phase. Now I'm interested in making Baxter move autonomously and interpretively. I've tried to teach robots how to dance, and one of the things I've learned is it's harder to do than you might expect. I found that humans can do the robot better than an actual robot, and I find that a comforting irony.
How would you go about using that in a theater setting? And I ask because if you're doing a play, for example, everybody has their lines. There's not necessarily, at the performance, a lot of interpreting. Everybody knows what everybody else is supposed to do. In a dance performance, everybody knows the steps they're supposed to do. So where would be the role of having sort of this thoughtfulness that a robot, in theory, would be able to learn?
Yeah, I'm actually not very interested in putting a robot in a play. If I'm going to have a robot that's autonomous, that can make decisions and learn in real time on its own, I'm not going to put it into a situation that could be performed by a VCR, by a pre-programmed robot. So I want it to be on stage with a dancer improvising with them. I want a dancer that can watch Misty Copeland dance and then move exactly like her.
Lance Garavi is an associate professor in the School of Film, Dance, and Theater at ASU. He's been working on making robots move more like humans. By now, you probably know that Punxsutawney Phil, the prognosticating groundhog from Pennsylvania, predicted an early spring. Well, KJZZ's own Phoenixsutawney Phil, Platzman, that is, prognosticating reporter that he is, makes his own prediction.
And rather than consulting my shadow, I decided to consult Ben McMahon with climate assessment for the Southwest.
The next couple of weeks actually look pretty dry, maybe a little warmer than average. Now, the lingering question is how much El Nino will still continue to play a role, because the next 2 weeks look a little dry, but there's still a very good chance that El Nino will bring us some wetter weather as the spring proceeds.
So, my prediction, 2 weeks of spring, followed by 4 more weeks of winter. We'll see who's right come mid-March.
Steve Goldstein is with me, the host of KJZZ's Here and Now. We should point out that Phil, before this, lived in Florida, where it's pretty much always spring.
Phil says it's a one-day winter there, usually.
Exactly, yes. Right. KJZZ's Here and Now tomorrow morning at 11. The head of ASU tomorrow.
Mark, ASU's president, Michael Crow, will talk about a new international partnership the university has come up with. He will also tell us what he thinks of legislative funding for the state's universities. He's not that happy, just to spoil it.
And he's not
right
one
there.
To mince words, usually.
No, not too much.
Also, you'll be talking about some international affairs.
Pulitzer Prize winner Thomas Ricks is going to be in town next week. He'll talk about why he thinks, based on the nature of war changing, why the U.S. could lose its next war.
That and much more tomorrow on KJZZ's Here and Now, right here at 11, tomorrow morning on KJZZ. And now, then, KJZZ's Here and Now. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. All things considered, coming up next, it's 3 o'clock.